It's draft time. Do the Browns really need a running back? Who should the Colts target? Dalvin Cook or Joe Mixon? Why do all these first-round offensive tackles stink these days? All that and much more in the draft edition of the Mailbag Show on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramley.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. This is the very special draft mailbag edition. I am Gary Gramley. He's Andy Benoit. And Andy, I don't even want to waste time introducing us at the top because we have a lot of questions to get to and we are going to get to as many as possible. And I've already wasted so much time.
Well, bring them on.
All right. Let's start from Twitter. This is Colin Brady at Quality Smoke. Is the 17 draft approach by Patriots unique? Trade high picks, young stack squad, draft and develop cheap mid-level undrafted free agents.
So what he's asking, I believe, in more of a general sense, and it gets into what do you value in a draft pick, is they're trading away their quality picks for players right now, for veteran guys. And I've never had an issue with that because the whole point of a draft selection, a draft pick, is to acquire a football player who can help your team. And if you think your better chance is a guy who's been on another NFL team before rather than a guy who's happened to have been in college the last few years, I think you should absolutely do that. So I think that's the way to look at it. And it's kind of counterintuitive to what we think of with New England. We always think of them as trading down to get more picks, and then we call them brilliant for doing that. I don't know why they get the benefit of the doubt every time. But this year they've gone in a different direction. And it suggests to me the other thing we always overlook with the Patriots, which is that they don't have a hard and fast methodology for doing stuff. Everything is very much on a year-to-year basis and a need-by-need basis, and they're just conservative in how they go about filling that. This year, that took them to Brandon Cooks.
Yeah, Cooks was obviously the big one this year. I mean, they've gone around to sort of other teams, first-round busts, and scoop some of them up, whether it be a Shay McClellan or a Kyle Van Noy or a Jonathan Cooper. You know, they've worked out to, you know, varying extents. But yeah, I mean, look, the overall trend in the league is you gather as many picks as you possibly can, and that generally, that's the trading down thing, and the Patriots weren't the first to do it. There were plenty of teams that did it for that, but that was certainly their MO in the past. And the thing with Cooks, they have Cooks cheap for 2 years, and I guess it's just, it's doing the math of saying, do we want this guy? Cooks is obviously a better bet to be productive over the next 2 years than anyone coming out of this draft. So, you know, are the 2 years of Cooks that you're going to get more valuable than the 4 or 5 years of, you know, draft player X? And if you want to win right now, and obviously with Tom Brady's age, they should want to win right now. So
yeah. Well, and the other thing is the downside of Cooks is a good problem to have. If he becomes too expensive after 2 seasons, it means he did very well for you in those 2 seasons. And you should never, in any part of your life, and football included, you should never try to avoid good problems to have. So don't worry about how much Brandon Cooks will cost. You got to pay players what they're worth if you want to keep them. And if they get to that point, that'll be good. The more he costs them in 3 years, the better this trade will be.
Absolutely. This next question is coming from Phil Quartararo, and that's Phil, by the way, F-I-L, not P-H-I-L. And this is also, you know, we had a loose rule, no two-parters. That was an internal discussion that Andy and I had, but this is a two-parter.
Oh, boy.
They're right
down
Andy's pipe. So we're going to get to both of them here. Let's see, 49ers related question. They have selected DeForest Buckner and Eric Armstead in the first round of the last two drafts. Could either player potentially play inside on base downs if the 49ers were to select a 4-3 defensive end like Solomon Thomas, or are those two guys solely 3-4 defensive ends?
So I've had this discussion at length with a lot of different people this offseason, this 49ers defensive line and what it's going to look like. It was built as a 3-4 under the previous regime. Last year was Jim O'Neill as defensive coordinator. Now it's Robert Saleh as defensive coordinator. He comes from Jacksonville, and it's going to be a traditional 4-3 type scheme like what we've seen with Jacksonville, what we've seen with Atlanta, what we've seen with Seattle. And the Niners have a lot of talent up front. And the question is, where does it go? How does it fit? And I actually watched several hours of Niners film last night for a different project. And I'll tell you what, at one point I did stop the film and think, my goodness, DeForest Buckner he is so quick for his build and his size. It's good to watch film in the offseason because you can watch things slower and you see things like that. Buckner might get lost in the shuffle a little bit when you're seeing everybody during the regular season. I think he can be a three technique, and I don't know if I would have thought that before last night. Otherwise, I was thinking he's more of a strong side defensive end, and really probably what we should be talking about anyway is where does he play in nickel, which means either a three technique or a wide nine. Those tend to be the two spots in nickel. I think Buckner can fill one of those inside. The other part of the question, though, Gary, the Solomon Thomas part, I don't think he is a 4-3 defensive end, and I can't for the life of me understand how everybody's seeing and saying that he is, because he played three technique at Stanford 85% of the time, and his skill set is clearly that of a three tech. He's better in confined areas than he is out in space. So I don't know if he's a fit for the Niners, because what they need is an edge rusher, and Thomas, while a great talent, he's not a pure edge rusher, and I don't know if you want to do that at number two then.
Yeah, people still lock guys in with what their sort of base, four linemen, three linebackers, three linemen, four linebackers, what that base alignment would be. But, like we see, I think I'm stealing this. I might be stealing it from you, but I also might be stealing it from the ESPN draft matchup show that they had on the other night. 67% of the time, league-wide, that's how often teams play what would be considered sub-package, which is five or more defensive backs. So, where a guy fits in base, at most he's going to play that third of the time. And I think the Patriots, for some like 80% of the time, they're in sub-package alignment. So,
you're stealing it from both of us, by the way. It's both because Greg Cosell, who I feel like we mention and I mention every week on this podcast, he's the guy behind the matchup show, and he and I probably had a 35-minute discussion about this very thing with Solomon Thomas. And that's the mistake people make. We look at these guys and think, how do they fit? Are they a 4-3? Are they a 3-4? All of that is so ancillary because of what you just said. You play nickel 65, 67% of the time, and in nickel you're not a 4-3 or a 3-4. You're a lot of different things.
Yeah, and Andy, of course, did the Solomon Thomas film room session. Great piece. Find it on the MMQB.com. And if I could just boil it down as simply as possible, Andy, Solomon Thomas is a different style of player than Michael Bennett, but that Michael Bennett role of, you put him at the sort of 4-3, edge base guy in the base alignment, and then kick him inside on your sub-package stuff.
Yeah.
That's the role he'll probably fit.
And on that 4-3 edge, it's the strong side edge. So it's not really a hard edge. It's not space so much. It's the opposite wherever the tight end is. And then the weak side defensive ends, the guy everybody talks about, the Leo, as all the Seahawk fans like to remind us. I don't think Solomon Thomas is a Leo at all. He's better with bodies around him, and somebody has to play the role with bodies around you. You might as well have him playing that because he is exceptional there.
Yeah. And second part of the question here, Carlos Hyde had a great year running back, but does not catch the ball a lot out of the backfield. Do they need to upgrade in that Kyle Shanahan offense to be able to run Shanahan's system? And Andy Benoit did the draft needs piece with the Emily Kaplan of the Albert Breer podcast and also of the MMQB and the college column and all that stuff. They did the draft needs and the prospects that fit. But Andy, you said the number one need for this 49ers team would be a pass catching back.
It would help them a lot because of how Shanahan plays. He is very good when he can move running backs and tight ends, but especially running backs, when he can move them around the formation. And think about, remember what Atlanta did to Denver back in week, I want to say it was week 5 last season. They went to Denver. Tevin Coleman had all those catches for big 50-yard gains. Devontae Freeman flexed out. He had a lot of catches. When you can move your running backs to create matchup problems out as receivers, that's where Kyle Shanahan is the highest of level of coaches. And Carlos Hyde is not that kind of back. He's a quality runner, but he's a backfield player. He's not a flex guy.
All right. Next question coming from Jürgen from Austria via TalkBack. So many young tackles like Luke Jockel, Greg Robinson, Eric Flowers, TJ Humphreys struggle badly. Is the main reason the new CBA? How can the NFL improve the transition of college offensive tackles to the pro level?
I love that question because that's exactly what people around the league are asking. We think about the college game and the pro game, and we talk about how different they are, and we think about quarterbacks when that subject comes up. Yeah, but the position that's becoming even harder to evaluate is those offensive tackles, because they are not asked to do anything in college that they're going to have to do in the NFL. The ball's out so quickly. Tackles in college are not challenged enough, and so therefore their film is incomplete and can be misleading. And this, who's our friend from Austria here is making the point.
This is Jürgen.
Jürgen, who's listing off all these guys, he's right. The offensive tackles have become almost a risky pick early in the draft because the transition from college to pro is so gargantuan.
Yeah, and you know, it's the same discussion we had with the quarterbacks a couple weeks ago, and what you do with the limited practice time to get them ready. And but nobody really has an answer right now as to how to work around that. You're just going to have to accept that they are, you know, they're also lottery tickets to an extent.
The other thing I think teams need to start considering, and let's use Greg Robinson from the Rams as an example, he's going to move to guard this season. And that's the new staff doesn't have any ties to him. They signed Andrew Whitworth, a solid, very solid veteran left tackle. Robinson's been a liability. So instead of having him at his left tackle spot, he's now playing at guard, where he has guys on both sides of him helping him as blockers. And his job's going to, in theory, be easier. That decision should have been made about 2 or 3 years ago. He should have been moved already because he hasn't shown the good enough feet to be a tackle. And I think, Gary, what teams do, they for some reason they think the left tackle position is significantly more valuable than left guard. And so they're always reluctant to move a struggling tackle over to guard because they feel like they're diminishing their value there. If a guy can't play at that position, if he's struggling as much as Robinson has, remember, he was benched at times, so he was playing not at all some weeks. If that's the case, then you need to change his position. He's not an NFL left tackle. So really, teams need to be looking less at positions and more at just general lineman traits. I think we get too tied into locking a guy into an offensive line position when he's coming out of college.
Yeah, absolutely. Next question is coming from our old friend Joseph Conroy. He's a repeat offender here. He's the one who asked he predicted the Brock Osweiler trade correctly, and
we taunted
him and laughed at him, and so we're giving him another shot. I curse Joseph Conroy's name every night before I lay my head down to sleep. But this is Joseph Conroy via Facebook. The Browns have talked about creating an offense that's very friendly for a quarterback with the much improved offensive line. Has Isaiah Crowell shown enough potential that the Browns will be able to lean on the run game for the next 2 years, or should they be looking to draft a running back in what is a loaded class?
The big secret with the Browns' offense last season, the obvious thing was everything was wrong. The secret was not everything was wrong. Their running game was actually very good. Crowell and Duke Johnson, their backup running back, who's really their scat back, their third down guy, their flex guy, they are an excellent 1-2 tandem. They don't need any help at the running back spot. I saw some mock drafts that maybe were projecting Leonard Fournette to the Browns somehow. I would be shocked if that happens. Crowell, I'm not saying he's as talented as Leonard Fournette, but he is a quality NFL back, downhill runner who can finish runs. He's a good zone runner. And you mix him with Johnson, who can move around, and he's a big pass-catching threat. That's exactly what you want in a tandem, and especially in Hugh Jackson's scheme. These guys are very similar stylistically to what Jackson had in Cincinnati with Jeremy Hill and Giovanni Bernard.
Yeah. Now they're pretty good shape at the running back spot here. I would not expect them to go running back first round. Maybe they do something late day two or day three. Next question is coming from Lassie H. Thompson at Lassie Thompson. Why hasn't there been a successful two tight end tandem since the 2011 Patriots, or has there? Is it lack of talent at the position, or do systems simply don't work as well as they did?
This is another good question. I actually had my research team look into this, and the question, it's kind of a leading one, but it's correct in how it leads you. There hasn't really been, statistically, there hasn't been a dynamic 1-2 tight end tandem. There, what was it, Hernandez and Gronkowski back in 2011, 2012, around that time, they were both over 800 yards receiving, give or take, and Gronkowski was over 1,000 yards receiving. We haven't seen anything remotely close to that since then. I think I want to say Vernon Davis and Jordan Reed maybe got close, but they're not a true they're not the tandem that Hernandez and Gronkowski were, of course. So then the question becomes, well, what's the deal with that? Because we talk all the time on the show how important it is to be able to have two tight ends, and I think the deal with it is, it doesn't, you don't need two tight ends producing. You need to be able to comfortably put two tight ends on the field. And just having that will dictate matchups across the board. It will influence what formations you use and what looks you get from the defense. And now everybody else produces from there. So it's not so much about the tight ends as they're not end products. They're more, they're channels. They're conduits to the end product.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, and Lassie kind of points it out, there has been a lack of talent coming from the college game into the NFL, and certainly that would play into it as far as the pure, you know, pure statistical production of some of these teams that that use two tight ends frequently. You know, players just aren't as good, and certainly no one has had the type of pair that Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez were 5-6 years ago.
And we haven't seen anything close to that either. The guy, the only guy who's close to what Hernandez was, and it's odd we're talking about him, of course, this time, but as we're talking just purely football player and coaches around the league, they are very uncomfortable with this conversation because he was such a deplorable human being, but everyone's looking for the next Aaron Hernandez. I mean, and they hate to say that, and obviously we know they mean only on the field, but he was such a special talent the way he could flex anywhere. I mean, he played running back in his final few games. The closest we've seen to that is Jordan Reed, stylistically, and then I don't think there's anyone close to Jordan Reed in terms of precision and dynamic route running. So the Hernandez-Gronkowski thing, that may we may look back and see that was just a meteor across the sky that never really turned into a whole sky of stars for them because of Hernandez and his problems and who he was. But we may never see a tight end tandem like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's certainly it's a very good class this year, so I don't know. Maybe there's a little more hope coming up. A lot of these guys are that sort of put them in different spots, you know, flex them out, play them as basically supersized wide receivers, so we'll see how it plays out here.
Hey, Gary, one more thing on the, because we've kind of touched on New England, and now we're into the Gronkowski tight end stuff. They want to recreate that. They want to recreate having a tight end who can play in the backfield as well as anywhere else in the formation. And I would not be surprised this season. Remember, they had Martellus Bennett last year, and they had big plans for what to do with that, and Gronkowski got hurt. Bennett wasn't always on the field with him. They've got Dwayne Allen now. I would not be surprised if they move Gronk around, similar to how they moved Hernandez around. If we see him coming out of the backfield – that would not – I could see that becoming a part of their offense. I know that was in the plans a little bit at one point.
I know you're kind of down on Dwayne Allen. I think they could maybe try him. And not he's not going to be doing the same things that Aaron Hernandez was doing 5 years ago. But I think he's a little more flexible than he was the way they used him in Indianapolis.
I think he's flexible, but in a very specific way. So Hernandez was flexible in any direction. He was multitude of flexibility. Allen, he's not twitching. He's not quick. So if you were to put him in a running back spot out of a shotgun like they were doing with Hernandez, it would take him too long to get into his route because the running back, you're 4 or 5 yards deep at least in the backfield. Yeah. So your routes take longer to unfold, and you have to have a quicker guy doing that. That's why the third down backs are always the smaller, quicker guys. You mm-hmm. have to be able to get out of your spot. So yes, he's flexible, but he's not flexible like that. That's why I think Gronkowski, who's not super twitchy either, but he's got so many other unique traits, it'll work. I could see him being the running back in their two tight end sets. Allen's a movable tight end, so a guy who goes in motion in short areas, maybe flexes out to the slot, but probably not a whole lot. He's more of an H-back, really, Gary, and that's fine. That'll work, because with him and Gronkowski out there, that's still the run or pass threat. You could throw or run out of those mm-hmm. formations with those two guys on the field. Allen might not be the threat who's going to catch the ball, but he still allows you to get into your passing designs.
All right. Let's go on to the next one. This is Peter via TalkBack. Given the Colts have multiple positions of need in a deep defensive draft, I would love to see Chris Ballard mimic the Chiefs' 2016 draft and trade down for extra picks. If you're the Colts GM, with which players could be available at 15 that would lead you to stay there rather than trading down? I think they want to trade down no matter what. I mean, if Myles Garrett is there at 15, maybe you talk about it, but then of course you're wondering why Myles Garrett is on the board at 15. But I think the Colts, I can't imagine anyone sitting there at 15 is going to be a guy they look at and say, you know, Reuben Foster is a guy maybe you could build around. Reuben Foster's a unique guy, and I wanted to ask you about him specifically, Andy. I know you haven't studied Reuben Foster, you don't know him that well, but one thing that is sort of coming out about Foster is Robert Klemko had done the piece on him. Nick Saban obviously runs a complex system down in Alabama. He was happy with the way Foster learned it and the way he was basically able to execute in that system. A lot of teams have a problem with Foster, during interviews. He is not good at drawing stuff up on the board. He's not good at articulating what he's doing, what he's seeing, type of thing. It's almost like he's what's the term? A kinetic learner? Like he okay, learns by yep. doing, but he can't really spit it back at you.
And that complicates things in terms of evaluating him. All I know about Reuben Foster is when I went and did the Reggie Ragland film room last year before the mm-hmm. draft. I kept saying to him, you know, who's this other linebacker out here? No disrespect to you, Reggie. You're great. Yeah. That's why we're here doing this. But this other guy's pretty good too. I don't know who the guys are. And he said, yeah, Reuben Foster is a talented player. And I think what makes him unique, at least at what the limited stuff I saw at Alabama when I was doing the Ragland project, is he's a good nickel type of linebacker. He can move around. He's fast. And so can he draw stuff up? Let's say it sounds like he can't. So then you want to put him in the situation where he's a reactor rather than a thinker. And that probably means having a veteran linebacker around him, having him in a very specific type of scheme. It doesn't mean he can't play. Another guy who's like this is Lawrence Timmons in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. You notice Ryan Shazier always wore the green dot, even though Shazier was 10 years younger than Timmons and had not been in the system at all. He still became the green dot guy because Timmons is better as just a loose, instinctive, reactive player. And Timmons has had a very nice NFL career. So this doesn't mean Foster can't play. Kiko Alonso's another guy who you probably don't want having to think a lot. And that doesn't mean he's dumb. It just means he's an instinctive, certain type of player. You can work around guys like that. You have to have them in the right situation.
Yeah. And then Foster obviously has some other problems. He failed the combine drug test and all that stuff. But, yeah, Peter, the Colts have to basically accumulate as much talent as they can. And it is a very deep draft. So if they can move down and pick up picks and address multiple spots, that's a good thing. I think the only thing that really doesn't slip in the draft anymore, and thing that's still a premium along with quarterbacks, is edge rushers. I think it's tough to find an edge rusher the deeper you go. So
the Colts will tell you, though, we found one in Robert Mathis a long time ago. And mm-hmm. They remember Jonathan Newsom for them. He's now, mm-hmm. I think yeah. he's in the CFL now. But he was another guy who was very talented, jumped off the screen. And there must have been something non-football related that helped his departure from the league because he's a good enough talent to be there. But the Colts have shown a willingness to take just pure athletes and play them on the edge. Now, that also torched them once. They did Bjorn Werner, and he didn't work out. And it is a different GM now in Chris Ballard, so maybe it's all academic anyway. But don't you think, Gary, I agree with you about defensive end, but it's also it's such a pure talent position in certain scenarios. That's not a thinking man spot. It's a, hey, you line up here and you go get the guy who's about to get the ball snapped to him. You can plug in an athlete and have him do that in theory.
Yeah, but I guess my thing is it's easier to assess those athletes. I think it's why teams are maybe more comfortable using a high pick on an edge rusher, and it's easier to identify who your top edge rushers are going to be. You know, there's no it's kind of like, well, physically, are you capable of doing it? You know, if you check that box, then you know, you're going to be a high round prospect.
And the one ability that always separates the haves and have-nots as edge rushing goes is the ability to bend around the corner. You can be fast, and you can even be twitchy and have change of direction ability, but if you can't smoothly bend around the corner as you're rushing, then you can't be an NFL quality edge rusher. You can still play, but you're not going to be a 15 sack a year type of guy. Mike Mamula is the example pointed out to me. Remember the Eagles bust many years ago. Great talent. I think there were people that said they staked their careers on him, and he had all kinds of ability, but he did not have that one ability to bend as he was rushing, and it doesn't work in the NFL if you don't have that. The best bender in the league is Von Miller.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you ever – Von Miller looks like he's running on, like, an imaginary ramp or something, if you sort of, you know, looked at him, like, knees up or something while he's turning the corner.
Yeah, or just like he's on a merry-go-round. You know how it kind of propels you and you feel yourself leaning in and almost like you're going to flip around? That's how he runs around out there.
It's such a weird – it's just a weird – it's a weird biomechanical thing. It's I don't know, some sort of, you know, marvel of the human body, I guess. This next one is coming from Ian from Queens via TalkBack. Why should coaches not be considered part of the salary cap as staffs balloon in size? It feels a little unfair that players are burdened with a cap limit, non-guaranteed money, and significantly higher injury risk than their coaches. Plus, wouldn't it be more interesting to see teams trade bad coaches on big contracts to Cleveland? They might start the season with three head coaches on the roster. That was funny. I like that last part again. But it's a good point. I can't remember if I'm stealing this from Peter King or Andrew Brandt, but they always say, you know, the best contract in the NFL is Bill Belichick's.
Overall contract, even better than players?
Yeah, because, you know, he doesn't count against the cap, and it's all kind of funny money.
Oh, like the most, so the best bang for your buck.
The best value, I should say, yeah.
Okay. Coaching salaries are interesting because coaches don't always know what other coaches make, and that's what makes them different from players. So a coach's agent is very important because that's the guy that has the information. And I know coaches around the league, high-profile coaches, that have said, yeah, once I got a certain job, I realized my previous job, they were paying me way less than they were supposed to, or way less than the market dictated. They just don't have the information available to them. And coaches are extremely valuable. They don't play. We don't see them on TV, so we don't always think about it. But if you get a good assistant coach, that's worth a lot to a team. That can make all of your players at his position 10, 15% better, and those are the guys you're paying the money to. So I like the idea. I'm intrigued by the coaching salary cap because the teams that can afford to pay coaches, they have an inherent advantage. Big market teams that naturally just have more cash flow and more money on hand, and we're not talking cap money now. We're talking basically business operations. We would have Andrew Brandt have to break this down. I don't know it like he does, of course. But those teams would have an advantage. If they have more money to pay coaches, that's a big advantage in the NFL that gets overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it would be interesting to see see teams have to factor that in there. Obviously, it's not something that is going to happen anytime soon. And it is, yeah, you're right, Ian. It is a little unfair that there's no salary cap for coaches, but there is for players. Next one's coming, Stuart, via Facebook, and this is a very draft-centric one. Character concern running backs. You have Dalvin Cook and you have Joe Mixon. Stuart says, to me, the attention on Mixon and lack of attention on Cook seems to be unbalanced. The quick backstory is Joe Mixon, of course, most of you know, was caught on video when he was before he arrived at Oklahoma when he was 18 years old, punching a woman during an argument in a restaurant. Dalvin Cook has some. He's been accused of some stuff in the past. He was accused and never charged of hitting a woman once at Florida State. He was charged with animal cruelty, and teams are. Everyone digs on these guys. Teams are concerned with some of the ties that Dalvin Cook has, back in his hometown of Miami. But the amount of reconnaissance work that teams put into these guys is pretty exhaustive and pretty mind blowing when you consider, I don't know, all the other things you could put resources into the world. As far as these two guys go, I just wanted to make a quick point because I've been asked about this quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. Dalvin Cook might go in the second round. Joe Mixon might go in the second round. And if Dalvin Cook went there, he would be considered slipping out of the first round. Mixon would be considered, oh my God, he went much higher than anyone thought. It's not a league-wide thing. It's not like 32 teams got together and deemed both these guys are second-round picks. It could be one team wanted to take Mixon in the second round and no one else had him on their board. It could be 15 teams thought about Dalvin Cook in the first round and no one pulled the trigger and he slipped. I can't say, I can't say who's the bigger risk, and that's what teams are trying to figure out right now. I know a lot of people around the league have said they think Dalvin Cook might have turned a corner last year, but you're about to give him a couple million dollars. What's going to happen? That's the risk-reward calculation you're going to have to take.
And you have to assume, and there's no way to know this, and it's not going to be true every time, but law of averages would tell you if you take a guy and make him a millionaire now, so now he's worth, might even literally be millions of what he was before, he's likely to become more of what he already is. He's probably not going to change. He's going to become a more extreme version of himself. The tricky part is all these guys are in their late teens, early 20s when these issues are coming up, so they're not the final versions of themselves. And I'm sure a lot of us would not want to have our future careers based on our low points in our late teens and early 20s.
Yeah.
The other thing, Gary, the guys that are doing this reconnaissance, and they do an exhaustive effort at it, they're mostly assistant coaches and guys at the training staff and front office and scouts who are football experts, but they're not psychologists, they're not investigators, private investigators, law enforcement officials. They don't have as much of that. Some teams, I'm sure, go to that extent, but yeah. You almost think teams need like special, if they're going to take this very seriously, and if there's no salary cap for it, they need to have special security detail guys that are doing the psychological testing, because I can't tell you how often I hear assistant coaches talking about all the psychological tests that they've come up with that they think work, and I asked this guy this question, and I know about him there, and everybody thinks they get these answers. Those coaches are no more qualified to do that than you or me, than a teacher or a garbage man or a pharmaceutical rep. I mean, it just doesn't add up.
And that's okay. And we won't delve too far and go too far on this tangent here. But that's look, I grew up in Connecticut. I worked at the Hartford Courant when Aaron Hernandez was a high school player there. I know the whole backstory, and it's tragic. It's tragic for everyone involved in it, the victims and the Hernandez family and all of that. But the thing that always blows my mind is the fact that everyone kind of thought, like, oh, these football coaches will save him. These football coaches are capable of, pulling this guy out and getting him on the straight and narrow and stuff like that. And no, there are professionals who do this for a living that you could have referred him to, and maybe things would have turned out differently. But football coaches, football programs, organizations, they think very, very highly of themselves and their abilities to, it's the obnoxious Coach K commercial. I'm not just a coach, I'm a whatever it was, I'm a builder of men or whatever.
Yeah,
and it's like no, you're a coach, and it's helpful. You can also help a little bit with this other stuff, but if there's a big problem, find someone else to deal with it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And that, some coaches can do it. Maybe Coach K is a guy. But if you remove Coach K's coaching pedigree, if he didn't have championships and gold medals. I guess they don't give him a gold medal, but if he hadn't coached gold medal teams.
He did. He coached the U.S. Olympic team.
Right, but he didn't get – remember they didn't give him a medal? The Olympics don't give the coaches a medal.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, physically he doesn't have a medal. He's earned one. It's probably on his Wikipedia page, but he doesn't have – beside the point, if you removed all that from Coach K – what kind of builder of men or builder of character is he then? And maybe he's still excellent, but you can't tell me that doesn't factor into the equation. And your ability to scheme up stuff, which is also just a snippet of coaching, especially a college head basketball coach, there is a interpersonal element to it, but a lot of it's your basketball IQ and your understanding of a strategic sport, which is irrelevant in the case of understanding a guy's day-to-day life and human behavior. So if you take that away, if he's not a good strategist, how good of a builder of men does he appear to be then? And there's no way to know that, but the answer is going to be not as good as he would have been with the strategy element.
Not many guys with a total package there. And we should mention, you know, with a lot of top picks, teams do bring in, of course, you remember the old Al Davis thing with the private investigator who followed around Jamarcus Russell. Obviously, that worked out really well. But I know the Rams, you know, the Rams have ex-law enforcement guys on their security staff, and they were the guys who went up and did reconnaissance on Jared Goff last year. Robert Klemko wrote about it last May or whatever it was. But so, you know, with some of the top prospects, they will do that, the guys you're really going to invest largely in. But
then you have to wonder then about the separation of powers, though. We have the security guys. They followed Jared Goff around. All right, so they should be the one making the final evaluation on Goff and that aspect of things. And I bet you anything, the quarterback's coach, the assistant area scout, or whatever they have around, those guys still render their opinions about Jared Goff and their unqualified opinions, and that still seeps into the overall discussion. They get listened to, I bet. When they get in the draft room, their opinion's still heard, and it shouldn't be if they have other experts around to render even more educated opinions.
Absolutely. Next question coming here. Nick from London. This is all you, Andy, here. Saw the Jags announce they're moving Paul Posluszny to Sam linebacker so that Miles Jack can get on the field. Could you please explain the different responsibilities of the Sam versus the Mike? Why would Jack be ready to play Mike but not Sam? Thanks in advance. Keep on potting. Thanks, Nick. Andy, take it away.
Yeah, boy, when I heard that Posluszny was moving, I thought that's the most surprising, biggest news of the offseason. I mean, that is the nerdy side of football. First of all, let's keep in mind, we just talked about you play nickel 65% of the time plus. So you only have two linebackers on the field mainly, and it's going to be Posluszny still and Telvin Smith because those guys are too good to take off the field, and Posluszny hasn't shown any sign of decline yet. So Jack might play Mike linebacker. It's not going to matter a whole lot because he'll still be getting 12 to 15 snaps a game like he did last season when he played outside. I don't know exactly what the thinking is. What my guess would be is they feel like they need someone on the strong side up on the line of scrimmage. So Jacksonville now, if you know, we're going to get very football nuts and bolty, but that's what you get with these Londoners and their questions. They're like that side of the game. I love London. But the Jaguars like to play a lot of under fronts, which means that their three technique is on the weak side, and then they have what we talked about is that Leo position, that weak side defensive end. If you're going to play an under front, you need a strong side linebacker who can play up on the line of scrimmage and essentially serve as a fifth defensive lineman. There's a bunch of geometric reasons why, but suffice it to say, you need a big thumping linebacker. And the guy that is a good illustration years ago, not many years ago, but remember Courtney Upshaw in Baltimore was a linebacker. Mm-hmm. He's a D-tackle now in Atlanta. But he in Atlanta brought him in as a linebacker because they play a lot of under fronts. And they were looking for a guy who can line up over the tight end and hold the point in run defense or also jam the tight end. If it's a pass play, jam him off the line of scrimmage. Jack is not a very big-bodied guy. Telvin Smith is too good on the weak side. He's too fast. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be putting him in traffic. You want him running in space. That leaves only Posluszny to play strong side linebacker. So that's the only thing I could think was why they would want to do that. Because, and I don't know all the rules of their defense and what their reads and keys are, and it's going to change upon the formation anyway. But the Mike backer is going to have more to read than the strong side backer in most scenarios. And Jack's not going to have a higher football IQ than Posluszny, so I would imagine that has nothing to do with the decision.
Yeah, You know, I think this kind of thing, maybe we revisit it in October or so and see how this kind of plays out. But it's interesting. You know, it might just be desperation of getting Jack on the field. But we got – Andy, I think we got time for two more here. Let's go Blaine from Washington, D.C. via TalkBack. I was wondering if a team or scout would ever watch Gruden's QB camp and take anything away from it. I would also think teams put QB prospects through more extensive, much longer and less theatrical version of this. But would a team ever watch Gruden QB camp to find things that they can take away from it?
Can I? I'm going to pull back the curtain and also humble brag. Can I do that?
Yes, you can. That's what we have a podcast for.
Right. So they ask the question is, would teams evaluate a QB based on how he looks in the Gruden QB camp thing? The answer is absolutely yes. And how I know that is because I'm always shocked at coaches who've told me they watched the stuff we do in the film room with prospects. And hey, I looked at that and what'd you think of it? And they ask genuine questions. They gather info from those things. And I always think, why? I mean, we're trying to be informative with this, but do you realize how highly edited those cut-ups are? When we're doing the film room stuff, we're in there with those guys for 2 hours probably, and those videos come out to 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we mislead people, but 4.5 minutes worth of 2 hours of 2 hours of conversation, I don't know why teams would look at that, but I know for certain that they do, and I know we've had teams that have taken guys very high in the draft that said they didn't. No one says, "Well, we evaluate them based on that." That factors into our decision.
Yeah.
But a lot of them say, "Yeah, we watched that and we found it good information." I always think, "Why?"
Yeah, I mean, we should do a special screening. We should get a movie theater and do a special like 2 hour screening of all of these for any interested coaches, see who shows up.
And it's not that, again, Gruden does a great job, of course. So it's not like the products aren't good. It's not that it's not good to do the film room stuff. It is informative. But the teams have all the access we have plus more. So why would they watch what we're putting out when they can meet with these guys themselves and ask them questions that pertain specifically to them? But there's no amount of information that's deemed too much information. And I know there have been scenarios. There was one time I did one of these with the film room guy, and even watching the film, he was evaluating what the opponent's look was. Here's what they were in. And it was wrong. It was flat out wrong. And I wasn't sure what to do with that later and how to write about it. That kind of thing, that would be interesting to a team. That would be of interest to them. The thing is, that usually doesn't get put out there.
Yeah.
Because it makes the guy look dumber than he is. He's right about 59 out of 60 plays. We're not going to put the one that he's wrong about out there and only show that for a half of the 4 minute video. But anyway, that's valuable info though, but I don't think the videos are showing that to the teams.
Yeah. Last question. Andy loved this question. This is from at Ito2590. Why do certain teams in the NFL represent states, Arizona Cardinals, Minnesota Vikings, while others represent cities? And of course, we have the New England Patriots. We have the Carolina Panthers. There's North Carolina and South Carolina. And they try to do both because they're down in Charlotte. And, the Buffalo Bills are the only team that actually plays in New York State. East Rutherford, New Jersey is not New York for anyone who's not familiar with the Northeast. But Andy, do you have a good answer for this?
I don't have a good answer other than that I've wondered about it myself. The team that drives me nuts, I don't know why the Indianapolis Colts are called the Indianapolis Colts rather than the Indiana Colts. Doesn't Indiana Colts have a much sleeker rhythm to it, just like Indiana Pacers? Indianapolis is such a mouthful, and there's nothing else in Indiana. They have that whole state to themselves. I don't know why they don't brand themselves for the entire state rather than just the city of Indianapolis.
It is. I'm surprised more teams don't do the – I mean, you couldn't be like the California Rams or something like that, but, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we always – the Bills always talk about, like, oh, we got to brand ourselves in Rochester and Albany and all this stuff. It's like, well, just call yourself the New York Bills now.
Well, the problem is there is no such thing as a Bill, and they have a buffalo as their logo and a buffalo
well,
on their
I guess
helmet.
That's a good point. But I don't know if this is true. The Cardinals, of course, when they first moved to Arizona,
yep,
they were the Phoenix Cardinals for a couple of years. I don't know if this is actually true or this was I can't even remember. I heard this back in like 1993 or whenever they changed the name, but they changed the name so that they could be alphabetically listed at the top of you know, any, I don't know, listing of NFL teams, because now they're Arizona instead of Phoenix.
Well, we've got if you ever look in your phone book, there's a lot of different companies that are named A1 this, A1 that, because back in around that time in the early 90s, when phone books weren't just trash, it showed up on your doorstep every 6 months, that people wanted to be the first one listed in that category, and that when people looked up the Yellow Pages. Arizona, that was smart of them, though, that people weren't showing up in Phoenix. They took the whole state. I like it. I wish more teams would go by their state. I'm trying to think what other teams. Like, obviously, you wouldn't want the Packers to be the Wisconsin Packers, would you?
I mean, you couldn't do it at this point because, you know, it's been Green Bay for too long, and that's part of their charm. But I don't know. Could you be the Missouri Chiefs now? Claim all the St. Louis fans.
Yeah. You could. The problem is you have Kansas. Kansas City sits right on the border. There's part of Kansas City is in the state of Kansas, if I'm not mistaken. They're probably technically two different cities. But
they are,
if you go
cities,
Kansas,
right?
City, you get the Missouri fans and the Kansas fans in.
I guess. How about the Georgia Falcons?
I think Atlanta is too much of a brand name type city. Atlanta's a big city.
You have like all the answers to this then. Want Indiana.
Yeah, if you're allowed to just spout bullcrap and not get called on it, I have all the answers. Neither of us actually know what we're talking about right now.
Oh, my New York Bills.
Well, yeah. How about your case? What is it? The Hartford Whalers? Is that what you call yourself?
Yes.
You need to be the Connecticut team. Whalers. You've been doing it wrong.
I don't know. Hartford Whalers. Everyone's so familiar with it worldwide. I wouldn't want to mess with the branding on that.
Yeah, and that probably gets back to the answer to this question: is why aren't teams called that? They probably didn't think about this a whole lot when some of these teams were founded, and that's just who they are now. Now it would be counterproductive to change the name because it goes against the branding.
That's a good wrap for this show. Thank you, as always, to producer Lou Pellegrino and editor Chris Basil, making the show sound so good. All the guys at Digital Media, we are thankful to have them. But mostly, we are thankful to have you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. We'll have more mailbags coming up. We'll do one in the next, probably the next 2 or 3 weeks once the draft wraps up and we sort of transition into how we're going to fill the offseason. Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI on Twitter. We're also both on Facebook, or you can write in to talkback@themmqb.com. Just put podcast somewhere in there so we find it. Send questions, send comments, whatever you got. Constructive criticism, it's all good. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Lots of good draft stuff there. The MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.